Welcome to Novelist Spotlight. This is my console. Those of you who have been writing for a while have somewhere along the line hopefully completed a manuscript or maybe two or three. And of course, what are we all told to do? We go to a literary agent. Because what we're told is don't go to Penguin, don't go to Simon & Schuster, don't go to any of the big or small publishing houses because they want the agents to filter it out. They want them to bring, you know, the good stuff to them. They don't want us authors just throwing things over the transom. But when we go to literary agents, we end up getting those form letters, those form rejection letters that say something along the lines of, in fact, I'll read just a couple to you from when I sent out my manuscript, Family Recipe, is a novel about Italian culture, Catholic guilt, and the culinary crime of the century. I regret to say that your project is not right for my list at this time, but there are many other literary agents out there who it may be right for. Another rejection letter I got said, after careful consideration, we have decided not to pursue your project. But basically went on to say, don't commit suicide yet, because these are matters that are subjective, and we feel certain there's an agent out there that will find your work an ideal fit for their book of business. Now, they didn't mention suicide. I threw that in there, but because that's how distraught we get sometimes. We get these rejection letters one after another. And I'm a guy who's got thick skin, but still, getting one rejection letter after another can be discouraging. But what if we had another alternative? And I'm not talking about self-publishing, because clearly that's an alternative as well. But what if some of the information that we've been told along the line has not been entirely accurate? What if we do have another alternative? What if I was to talk to a woman who took advantage of that alternative and can actually tell us about it? That's who's in the spotlight during this episode. Her name is Louise Marburg, and she's a New York City denizen. She studied design at Kansas City Art Institute. She's also a graduate of NYU. She holds an MFA in fiction from Columbia University School of Arts. And her stories have appeared in numerous quarterlies and publications. Look at the program notes below, and you can see her bio there. She's a native of Baltimore, but currently lives in New York City with her husband, the artist Charles Marburg, whose work focuses on organic and geometric forms. Now, Louise Marburg's writing includes the short story collections No Diving Allowed and The Truth About Me. I love that title, The Truth About Me. Louise Marburg, welcome to Novel Spotlight.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
You know, you came to my attention because you wrote an article for Writer's Digest magazine, and the headline reads, Who Says You Need an Agent? 8 Tips for Finding an Independent Publisher. I want to read the subtitle as well. It says, The Road That Leads to Publication Has Many Routes. Author Louise Marburg offers 8 tips for finding the right independent publisher for you. So, and you say congratulations on the book. Now what? So, what I'd like you to do, to begin with, you heard my intro. Mm-hmm. You heard what I was saying. It seems that we're all told, find a literary agent. That's essential because they're not going to talk to you. What about, rather than speaking to that point specifically, why don't you go through the 8 tips from that article with us?
Okay.
Starting with number one, which is make sure your book is in great shape. Hopefully anybody who's approaching an agent is going to make sure it's in great shape. But go ahead and elaborate on that. Let's go through those 8 steps and look at some alternatives here.
Well, you know, your book might not be in great shape. Often people submit their book before it's ready because they're excited. They think it's done. So I hired an editorial consultant for No Diving Allowed, and it was a great thing because he was, you know, a fresh eyes, and I was able to tighten up the book. So that's a really good option for, you know, or just a friend, you know, who's a writer, whatever you can do to have fresh eyes on your book. So
let me stop you for a second right there. You said tightened up the book. What were some of the, so he found some superfluous language maybe or some extra words in there. Were there anything else he did with the manuscript or pointed out to you that you went ahead and implemented at that point?
Well, he has a great saying, flabby dialogue. And I love that. That's a real problem. It's too much dialogue that doesn't really move the story forward. So I had a lot of that. I love writing dialogue. So he was great with that. And just little things, you know, like don't call this person that, you know, call it that. You know, it was just, you know, a lot of things. And I also had tried to get an agent, and he was really, you know, I knew him, and he gave me some ideas for how to make a story better. So that was great. As many people as you can get when you're writing something, I write stories, so it's a little easier. They're shorter. It's a lot easier, actually. But as many people as you can get to look at your work is great, you know, to just know that you've done the best. And if someone says, I don't think it's really ready, you know, it may not be. So that's
and you want knowledgeable thing. People. These are, you want people who are really, yes. They understand writing. They're good writers. They're friendly readers, not in that they tell you, oh, you're wonderful, but that they are not going to savage it for no good reason without giving
you
any.
So you don't want your best friend
for making it better.
Yeah, exactly. You want someone who you know, but not your best friend, you know, not a family member. But even a family member, just to, I think really I use everybody I know to read my stuff. So that's number one. Number two is investigate your options. So, you know, people write all sorts of different things. I write literary fiction, which is, you know, one compartment of independent publishing, but there are independent publishers for everything. And all you have to do is research it. And it's really easy. Just go to Google and see what comes up when you write independent publishers accepting submissions for science fiction or fantasy or whatever. There are a ton of independent publishers who are dying to see your work. So,
You say in your article that tool number one is Google. Enter independent publishers accepting blank submissions. Fill in the blank. So in your case, it was literary fiction, literary short stories.
Short story collections. Yeah. Mm. So I think, you know, long ago, that's how I started. Now, of course, I know a lot more about what publishers would be interested in my work. But that's, you know, that's how you start. And then, you know, as I say in the article, if you read what you write, check who's publishing those books, because sometimes they are independent publishers and you might be interested in them. So I think it's important to know the right publisher to approach. I write stories that are somewhat humorous, and I know that there are some publishers and some editors that aren't interested in humorous works. So I don't approach them. It's just
makes sense. I would check me on this. I would think, and most independent publishers are not necessarily looking for commercial fiction, that they're filling in these gaps in the market, that there's an opportunity to be more literary perhaps, or that they see that, hey, the big publishers are just leaving this lane completely open. So that's the lane that we're going to fill.
Well, commercial publishers are really interested in what's going to sell. Independent publishers, not so much. In fact, some of them really just don't care. They're interested in creating a work of art. Certainly my first publisher was that way, but it's not just literary work that you can really find an independent publisher for really any kind of genre. My genre is literary fiction. There are a number of publishers that specialize in that and want that. And literary fiction is really hard sell in commercial publishing. So yes, it is the place you fit in. An agent won't even, you know, things are popular. There are fads, you know, there are fashions in writing. And so if you don't fit into that, what's going on right now that an agent feels they can sell, it really has nothing to do with the quality of your work. It has to do with what they can sell. So.
Well, and I've also heard, Louise, that, and probably you have too, that if they've got, say, a legal thriller, it doesn't matter if you come along with a legal thriller that's a better piece of work than what they've already got. That pipeline, we've got a book for that this year or a couple books for that this year. That door is closed. Wonderful piece of work, but the pipeline is full for the year. Or maybe the next two or three years.
Yeah. Yes. So, you know, there are a lot of reasons why an agent would say no. And a lot of times they just don't even read it or they don't respond. You know, they're busy and some of them aren't very nice. So that's something to consider. Do you really want to get involved with somebody who maybe you don't like? just because they're an agent. Agents are hard to find, and you kind of have to take what you get. But you can have a better experience publishing your book. And that's what I think is important, is the experience.
Let me anticipate the thought bubble that's over a few people's heads right now, that if I do go to an independent publisher, and maybe you're going to get to this, but you tell me if we should just hold still. Otherwise, I'll just be foreshadowing this. If I do go to an independent publisher, you know, and I don't have a literary agent represents me, tries to get as much money as possible, tries to get the best deal, because he or she gets a piece of that action anyway. If I go to an independent publisher, they throw a contract in front of me. It could be like the old record deals back in the day. It could be completely slanted. I might be signing away my rights to the to the content and so on. Was there any concern about that when you were approaching independent publishers?
Well, fortunately for me, I got very simple contracts because I write short stories. It's not going to be a movie deal. There's very little that can happen after the book that they're going to take money from. But I do know people with novels who have published them independently, and they have had to dicker over the contract. And a really good source for that, if you need a lawyer or somebody to, you know, the second pair of eyes, is the Authors Guild. The Authors Guild, if you're an author, you join it, and they have free legal advice. So you can send the contract to the Authors Guild, to the lawyers there, and they'll send you back their notes on that. So a friend of mine just did that recently, and she's being published by an independent publisher, and it was just a really Byzantine contract. So,
So number three is check out some book fairs.
Yeah. So book fairs are really important because you get, you know, all the booksellers are there, and a lot of them are independent booksellers. It depends on the fair, but going around talking to, you know, a table, you know, that's an independent publisher, and talking about the things that they like, and maybe getting their card and having, you know, striking up a relationship. Can I send it to you? That kind of thing, you know, it's very common at book fairs. My favorite book fair is AWP, which this year is in Philadelphia every year, and it's in a different city. Really fun, huge book fair. Lots of panels on publishing and writing, and tons of panels. It's really fun, and I recommend going to that if you've got the means to get there. Yeah, so I've definitely met a lot of people that I've wanted to meet, like editors at journals that I've had stories accepted at that I've never met. And I'm going to be meeting my current publisher at AWP in Philadelphia, because they live, you know, not near me. So I that's the only opportunity I'll have to meet them.
So where are they based? Where's your current publisher based?
Well, it's interesting because my first publisher was based in San Francisco, second one in Raleigh, North Carolina. And this publisher, this is very now, is based nowhere. So the three editors live in Iowa, Massachusetts, and Tennessee.
So now, Finish that thought.
No, it's just, you know, it seems like a pandemic kind of thing that's happened. You know, exactly. People are nowhere. They're nowhere and everywhere. So
yes, it's a good way of putting it. So do they tend to be independent publisher deals, tend to be one-off deals? Because you had one independent publisher on one, and then you had a different one on the next book. So do they tend to want to just add an author to the stable and a piece of work to that stable, but they're not interested in a multi-book deal?
Well, I don't know that I can answer that, because my first publisher, who I adored, and I would have loved to publish with her again, didn't like my second book. It was very different, and I understand why it was not her thing. And actually, when I gave it to her, I thought, this is not her thing. This is stupid. But I love her, and so we're still great friends. My second publisher, it was not working for me. Much bigger publisher, and I thought, you know, if I can, I'm going to go somewhere else. Also, their publishing lead time is huge. So if I gave it to them, I would be published in like 2025. I'm not getting any younger. So anyway,
in my lifetime, please.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
I don't want to be honored posthumously.
Yes, exactly. So that's just what happened. And I very much like, so far, my new editor is terrific. And we'll see what happens with that. But yeah, every time I've written a book, I have thought, oh my God, this is going to be the one that doesn't get published because, you know, I've not stuck with the same publisher and I have to send it out to, you know, again, it's like fresh, you know, to totally.
And you've
fresh.
Changed your style because you, mm-hmm. you're not everybody wants to write detective novels one after another. And it's the same character doing a different case.
Yeah.
You know, I'm that way myself that I get, you know, I don't want to revisit the same subject. It's like there's this whole new subject and whole new set of characters to explore.
Yeah.
And if you do that, then you might run into the situation you did. But you found a different independent publisher who wanted your work.
Yes.
Because obviously the quality of your work is good. It's just a question of who's
the right person. Who's the right printing press here.
Yeah. Yes.
So, I mean, my new publisher said when he read my collection, he laughed out loud. And I thought, okay, now we are copacetic. You understand.
We're onto something here. Yes.
Yeah, you want the editor to understand your book and to really love it. But, you know, in commercial publishing, there is no guarantee that your publisher is going to take your next book. And a good friend of mine had a book published by Knopf, very good publishing house. They did not want anything else she wrote. And so she and her agent had to go out and find another publishing house.
Interesting. You know, I always think in terms of letting an agent know that this is, you know, my third or fourth manuscript I've also published, boom, boom, mm-hmm. boom, not mm-hmm. published, but written. Because I always think in terms that an agent or mm-hmm. a publisher wants to know that you're just not a one book person, because if this is successful, we're going to want you to do some more, or mm-hmm. we're going to want to look at your inventory. But that's not necessarily the case, is what you're saying. Okay.
No, in fact, I had an agent say to me, well, this is a really good book of stories, but it's not a debut book. And he said, "There, you know, publishers are much more interested in debuts," which I thought was interesting. What you say makes sense to me. You know, you want somebody who has got some books behind them, but no, not at all. So,
yeah. So number four is enter a contest. And
yes.
when you say enter a contest, you're a short story writer. So are you mm-hmm. Were you entering short stories? Or are you saying, because there aren't really contests for novels, right? It's
oh, no,
short stories.
There are. No, there,
oh, there are
tons.
Okay.
Yeah, they're just contests for fiction. So I enter a contest for fiction and also the, you know, the subsector for short stories, which aren't that many of those, but it's for fiction. So the contest I won recently was for short stories. So that I love that the publisher does short stories, essays, and poetry. But the one before, in fact, was for short stories. But the one before that, it could have been, you know, any piece of fiction. So
why enter a contest? Because you want some bragging, right? You want to be able to say that it's been recognized in some fashion by people who are flooded with entries and they put a critical eye on it and they said, you are a winner, you're a runner up, you won placed or showed.
I don't put much on that. I'm not really interested in that. The reason why I enter contests is it's a way to be published. You can submit to independent publishers through their submission windows, but also contests. Some of the publishers only accept non-agented work through the contests. So that's the contests are important with some publishers. So that's why I'd say, you know, one of the ways is to enter a contest. It's not necessarily, you know, something you have to do, but
well, it's another option, another way to put a brick in place.
Well,
what about number five?
Number five, submit your manuscript to open calls. Okay, so you have to keep your eyes open and, you know, have a calendar of when these independent publishers accept submissions, because some accept them all year long, and that's great. Some just for a very short time, some for a longer time. It really depends. But you need to know when the publishers that you've chosen will take submissions, because it's not necessarily all the time. So keep your eyes open, keep a calendar. It's important.
Now, number six is send your work to literary journals. Now, that sounds a little like, almost like the contest, because you're submitting to a literary journal. They get a lot of submissions. But a literary journal, if you can get published in it, that's quite a feather in the cap.
Well, it is. It's a great thing to have. But also, I've been approached, if indeed you want an agent, which, you know, I write short stories, so it's not only do I not want one, it's out of the question. But if you have a novel and you've submitted a short story that's, you know, published in the journal or an essay or whatever, I've been approached by an agent one time over a short story. He said, if you got a novel, I'm interested. I love this story. But novels are really the only thing that as far as fiction goes, that agents are interested in. They're not interested in short stories. But I think the more energy you send out there, the more you're out there, regardless of what you're doing, sending out, and even if you're not getting any takers, it's just a good practice to keep on sending out. And also, you say you're thick-skinned. I am also very thick-skinned, but not everybody is. And I think it takes a lot of practice to be thick-skinned and to get those rejections and to know that they're not necessarily a judgment on your work. It's there are a lot of reasons why you'll get a rejection, and it's not necessarily the quality of your work.
Yes. Yeah. That's important to recognize. And so when an agent says, no, I'm not interested in short stories, they're hard to, they don't tend to sell as well. Although
actually true.
I was going to say recently, I mean, George Saunders hit number one with the 10th of December.
Oh my God. That was such
it seems
book.
Like we're in an era where people are interested in the shorter form.
Yes,
but
they are.
I've been told that if you're a successful, if Stephen King wants to write a collection of short stories, they're going to be all over it. Or anybody who's established. But if you're a debut author and you're trying to get an agent to represent you, it's kind of like a short story collection.
Well, if
short stories
only
are going
to
jump all over the place. You know, they have different, everyone has a different theme. So it's not like with a novel, it's got a theme. With a short story collection, every one of the short stories tend to be different, although I've heard about, that linking them together.
Linked stories.
On.
Yeah. Or a novel in stories. But, I just lost my train of thought. What were we saying?
I interrupted you there.
No, you can get your short stories published commercially if you have a novel to sell with it. So if you've got a novel, they will publish your short stories. If they're interested in the novel, they will do the short stories. But
now, how does
only
that work? You're saying you're submitting them simultaneously, and then they say
exactly.
We like them both.
Or you could say I have a novel and I'm in the middle of a short story collection. They're still interested, but I only write short stories, so it's just I'm just not interested in writing novels, so it's fine. I'm not interested in agents either, because I think I said in the article that I've had one and it did not go well. When I actually have written a couple of novels. I think getting your energy, out there, getting people to know who you are, regardless of whether you have success or not. It's a lot like going to the book fairs and saying hey to everybody. Just get into the community of writers.
There's a whole ecosystem out there.
Yeah.
And so in addition to wanting to get to know independent publishers or agents for that matter, number seven, you say get to know other authors.
Yeah, that's really important too, because other authors can help you, can say, as I do, I just sent an open submission announcement to a couple of people I know with novels who are trying to get published. Because my eyes are always open, and we all help each other. And well, you hope they do, but my experience is that we all help each other, and that's really important. But also getting back to make sure that your novel or whatever book you've got is tight. Your author friends, you can use them to take a look at your work, and they'll give you the real skinny on it.
You can commiserate together. You can celebrate together. You can commiserate together.
Right. And Facebook, I mentioned Facebook, just friend authors. You don't have to know them. See what they're doing. Like a lot of us have
friends
press.
On Facebook that are now friends in reality. I don't even know half of them. So. What's the real definition of a friend anymore? In the age of social media, a friend has a whole different meaning.
Yeah, it really does. But I'm friends with a lot of authors, and I needed to get some blurbs, which are, you know, little some words about your upcoming book from authors, and I knew them from Facebook, so I really didn't have any trouble asking them for blurbs, which is can be difficult to get somebody to write, yes. You know, because you know I have to read the book and then I read the blurb. It's a big, you know, it's a pain in the neck. Mm-hmm. So get to know as many authors as you can, and hopefully authors that do the same thing that you do. And another way to do that is to go to writing retreats, or a conference. The conferences are great. I think I've been to two different conferences. One, I went three times. It was so great. And to one writing retreat. I met a ton of people, a ton. So it was fun. It's fun to meet other authors. So this isn't all just business. It's a lot of fun, too.
Yeah, you might as well enjoy it, because we have to spend a lot of time sitting alone in a room.
Yeah.
And social. And some people are introverted and aren't all that social, but a lot of us are. Mm-hmm. And to have a community there to get together, to celebrate the lifestyle, and also the get connected to the full ecosystem is a good thing.
Yeah.
Now, last but not least, you say consider hybrid publishing. And I know a guy who is a friend of mine who's published several books, and he said, I've never heard of hybrid publishing.
Oh, really?
Believe it or not, there's a lot of people out there that haven't heard of it. So tell us about that.
Okay. So hybrid, there are a number of hybrid publishers. Hybrid is when you actually pay, they publish the book, the publisher does, but you pay a certain amount of the cost up front. And through that, you get higher royalties. So it's
presumably they still have a vetting process that is rigorous. They're not just going to say, give us money. And because they're putting money behind it too.
They are indeed. And they're putting their reputation behind it. So yes, it's rigorous. It's just as rigorous as anything else. But that is their model, is that you put up a certain amount of money, and I've seen, and then you get the good royalties, more than you would get otherwise. And I have seen hybrid books reviewed. In fact, I've seen, I think one time, even in the New York Times, I saw a hybrid book reviewed. So it's definitely something
that's
to consider.
A big deal.
Yeah, that is a big deal.
So often you hear that, New York Times book review or any of the big book reviews, they say, well, they're not going to touch it unless it's the traditional route.
Right. But they're getting a little looser now. I mean, because independent publishing has gotten a lot bigger over the years. And it's you know, in my opinion, it's a way cooler way to publish. You don't get the exposure, certainly. And you don't get, you know, a ton of money. I don't know how much money you would get, you know, you can get no money publishing commercially as well. So, if you're going to publish independently, and I always say this is not about anything but the experience. So, you know, find an agent that you really like, who really likes your book. And that's easy to do an independent publisher, because they're not going to take your book unless they love it. So it's a great thing. It's a really good way to go. I've really enjoyed it.
So there you have it. I would invite listeners to go ahead to, if you want to read the full article, go to Writer's Digest, who says you need an agent, is 8 tips for finding an independent publisher. You can go ahead and put that in the search bar to find the article. But we have more to talk about with Louise right now, because I want to talk about short story writing. You're a short story writer. You said you've written a couple of novels. When you did write novels, did you treat each chapter as a short story? I mean, did you use that kind of a mind frame where you decided each one of those I'm going to treat as a short story? Obviously, there's a continuity there, a continuum of some sort. Talk about why you favor, how you wrote the novel vis-a-vis a short story collection. What really appeals to you about short stories that the full-length novel doesn't do for you?
Well, it's interesting because, yes, to answer your question, I did write the chapters like short stories, but I didn't do it on purpose. I'm just a natural story writer. It's the thing that interests me most. And the kind of thing I read a lot of novels, but I really read many more short story collections and have always really, even before I was a writer. So that is the form I enjoy most, the one I'm best at, and the one I most naturally go to. So I remember the last novel I wrote, which I look back at these novels and I think, oh my God, they're horrible. But the last novel I wrote, I sent to somebody and she said, you know, this is like a collection of short stories. And I said, oh my God, you're right. I'm not going to write any more novels. This is ridiculous. I'm going to write short stories. And that was the best decision I ever made. It's much more satisfying for me.
When you approach a short story, what's the typical length of your short stories?
About 4,000 to 5,000 words.
Interesting. So I remember Dwight Garner inside the New York Times Book Review podcast was talking about a short story collection that he had read that, and he liked it very much, but he said some of these short stories were as short as a paragraph or two, which sounds to me like flash fiction.
That's flash. That's not short story. That's flash.
No, they weren't all that short, but they were all quite succinct. But the idea of just a paragraph or two, that's almost not, I suppose.
It's not the same thing. It doesn't have the same structure. It doesn't have the same arc. Flash is just so, I haven't ever written flash, but it's the latest thing. It's quite the fashion flash. And it's good, you know, it can be very, very good and not good as well, like anything. But there can be a short story collection that has tiny little stories as well as longer stories, you know, and that's just the way it's put together. So flash is accepted.
Who do you, name a few short story writers who you think are really top notch when it comes to the form?
Well, you know, my original heroine was Alice Munro. I just was in love with her, and I still am. But you know, that was my first love was Alice Munro, and I really like a more contemporary writer is Deborah Eisenberg, who I really love her. She's very witty, very smart writer. I'm reading some stories by Lily King right now. They're good. She's a very good writer. Jill McCorkle, also an incredible short story writer and novelist. I'm often compared to John Cheever, my work.
Wow.
Well, I mean,
that's quite a comparison. That's
Well, I mean, I think, you know, not in quality, but maybe just in feeling. But so I do like John Cheever and John Updike and that all that sort of era of short stories. And, you know, essentially, I mean, I also read a lot of essays, which are not short stories, but they are, can be so entertaining and so inspiring, I think. That's really when I read the best stories, the best essays, the best novels inspire me to write. So I just want to put it down and go write because it's so good. You know, and it makes, it just makes you think. And something that's not that great, you think, oh, whatever. I put down a lot of books. I just, you know, if I'm not into it, I just say, oh, forget it. So,
you know, I had an English teacher way back in the day. I was in junior high school. His name was, I think it was Peter Gallagher. His last name was Gallagher for sure. Wild-eyed Irishman, really theatrical as he taught the class. One of the great teachers I had who I didn't really appreciate until later in life when I think back on him. And the fact that I've remembered him all these years says something right there. But he had somebody approach him who was a writer and said to him, I have writer's block. And he said there's no problem with that at all. All you have to do is go to a library, pull five or six interesting books off the shelf, sit down and start reading from each of them. And I've always found that to be the case. I mean, I've never really had writer's block, I definitely, along the lines of what you just said, Louise, reading something and just being inspired by it and feeling like it just kind of opens me up and gets me looking at what I'm working on differently, and also just kind of giving me some other thoughts about how I might approach things, because there's just so many different ways to approach writing, and there's just so many different writing styles. And you know, we always have to be cautious of not trying to sound like somebody else, just really being ourselves, but at the same time, that kind of inspiration can certainly be a huge assist.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I can hear a siren in the background. You're in New York City.
Really?
New York City. Yeah, I heard one go by.
No, I don't even hear it anymore.
You know, I was going to say, New York City, what a great, I mean, I grew up in upstate New York, so we went down to the city often, see baseball games and such. My dad would bring the family down and so on, go to the Statue of Liberty and what have you. Is New York City, there are people who like to think in terms of, you know, go to On Golden Pond and write, get away, you need silence. Other people, I tend to be energized by having a lot of people and activity around me. Uh-huh. What about that environment for a writer? Is it, you've been there for a long time now.
Many years. Oh yeah, a long time. And also, I work in the same room with my husband, who's a painter, as you said before. We live in a loft, which is about 2,000 square feet, and he's at one end, and I'm at the other. So we have that distraction as well. But, you know, it's interesting because when I was more of a novice writer, I had a harder time going to the computer and doing it. Now, I mean, I can really sit in the middle of the street and write. I can write anywhere. I just have that focus, and I'm very fortunate to have it. So yeah, I did hear that siren, but probably less so than you. I mean, I really did just, you know, whatever. I just don't even hear it. I become so focused on what I'm doing. And that, you know, I have written in the country. I've written in the city. I've written on planes. And it's the same wherever I am. It's the same. Although I don't really like coffee shops. I don't understand people who go to coffee shops. That's not my thing.
Yeah. Well, tell me about your writing regimen. I mean, your daily process of writing involves what? Is it morning? Is it evening? Is it midday? Also, do you work for a certain number of hours? Do you strive for a word count? What's your style of writing?
Well, I never
not the
strive
actual
for
verbiage,
right.
How you approach it.
I never strive for a word count or hours or any of that. I don't think about that at all. Because sometimes I will go to a story that I'm in the middle of and I will not write a word, but I will be reading it and thinking about it, you know, where to move next with it. So that is equally in my mind, writing. It's with the time I'm spending with the story. And I am more of a sort of after lunch to dinner writer, whenever that is. So, not so much a morning writer, but it really depends, because if I'm really into a story, if I'm like booking, then I will write it all the time. I'll be like, get up in the morning and, you know, just go crazy. And so I think I will write, if I have half an hour to sit down and write, I'll just do that if I don't have any other time. Or I can write for 4 or 5 hours. Probably not longer than that.
So your typical short story, and maybe nothing is typical, how long does it take you to complete a short story, would you say, on if you were to average it out?
About a month.
And what do you look to accomplish with a short story? Because with a novel, you've got a big stretch. It's a major commitment, and characters evolve and whatnot. Short stories tend to be more vignettes. But how do you know, when you go into the short story, do you know that you're trying to accomplish something in terms of what you want to communicate to the reader?
No. And I think that the short stories are really different than novels this way. I think, I don't know, but I think there are a lot of novelists who outline what they're going to do before they do it. I don't know if you do that, but they have more of an idea of what's going to happen or what the theme is, or, you know, what you know, what they think the ending, some people have to know what the end is in order to write the beginning. I have no idea what I'm doing until I do it. And for me, that really works. It makes me happy. The magic is there. And I sit down to write and I think, I cannot do this. It is too hard. And then I end up writing it and I really don't remember how I did it. It's just things happen and I write and it just works out.
So it's organic. It's organic. It develops on its own accord. You just put the time in and it resolves itself.
Yeah.
And I've had that experience. I've spoken about that experience where, in fact, it was a painter. I'm going to tell you this story. I've said it once before on the podcast because your husband's a painter. Uh-huh. But this fella named Paul, who's with the Charlotte Art League in Charlotte, North Carolina, he showed me his work. You know, he was a friend of my wife, and he was showing me his work. And he said, you know, I start a canvas, and I think this is never going to work. It's impossible. This is just a mess. It can't possibly work. And he says, and you know, I just keep at it. And he says, and like magic, it works. And he says, every time it actually goes somewhere and I complete it. And then he put the time in every day, and he pointed on that end of my workspace is my early paintings. And you go right around the whole area and up to the present. And the evolution of his work was tremendous. It got so much better in that panorama there. But I said to my wife then after talking to him, that's exactly what happens when I'm working on a chapter. I'll write something, it's a mess, and I'm thinking, I know what I want to accomplish, but this is never going to work. I'm stuck. I don't know what to do. Not stuck for the words, just stuck for making it really come out. And lo and behold, as you say, that magic happens. And that's part of the reward of the writing.
It is.
It's an act of faith. That's another term that a writing coach used with me. And I've embraced it ever since, and I've repeated it ever since, that writing's an act of faith. You have to believe that that if you keep at it, it will come to full realization.
Yeah, it will. And I think it's really important not to get tied up in knots about it, because then you don't let that magic flow in. And I never do. And, you know, if I get too conscious about a story, I just drive it into the ground. And then I have to stop. It's terrible. So I really tried to keep my mind open and to see what happens and to see what I've written, you know, and see maybe it's telling me something that I need for the next, you know, however many words. So it's important to really relax.
Do you have a couple minutes of, I should have talked to you ahead of time, but I can certainly, observe a time delay here. Do you have an excerpt from your writing that you could read to us?
Sure. I'll read to you from my most recent book, No Diving Allowed. This book is called No Diving Allowed. Well, that's after one of the stories, but there is a swimming pool in every story.
Oh, and, interesting. Okay. Hence the title. Linked in that way.
They're linked in that way. Otherwise, they're quite different. So I'll read for just a few minutes from a story called The Bottom of the Deep End. My mother's younger brother, Patrick, had been married twice, was single again, and was seeing a woman who wore pantyhose even on the hottest days and high heels to show off her long, lovely legs. Look at those stems, Patrick would say, and Alicia would stretch out a toe. My mother said Patrick wanted to marry Alicia, but that he shouldn't because Alicia was common. Common or not, I didn't think she'd marry anyone, because at 36 she hadn't yet. 36 seemed ancient to me. I was almost 19. I had nothing to do because I hadn't made any plans. A gray lethargy had come over me in winter and stubbornly outlasted spring. Then all of a sudden I was home from college and summertime had begun. I didn't have a job and I didn't want one either. I hung out in my bedroom while my mother was at work, drawing and thinking and listening to music until sunlight abandoned my window, telling me the day was spent. I went downstairs when I wanted a snack or to take a dip in the swimming pool. Often Uncle Patrick would show up in the afternoon and I would forget myself in the pleasure of lolling around in the water with him, exchanging observations. I didn't know what he did for a living. No one had ever told me, and I was self-absorbed enough not to wonder. He didn't ask what I'd been doing or wanted to do the way adults usually did, and I was grateful not to have to think up lies or make excuses for myself. There was always a gin and tonic sitting on the edge of the pool, mixed at my mother's bar. Slowly, he would sip it until the ice cubes rattled against the glass and our fingertips were prunes. One afternoon, he brought Alicia. They were already swimming when I came out. I was disappointed not to have my uncle to myself. I dove into the deep end and swam the length of the pool. "Do you have a boyfriend?" Alicia asked when I surfaced. Her own gin and tonic sweated on the coping next to Patrick's. Her reddish blonde hair was piled on top of her head, and she was wearing a full face of makeup. She swam with her head held high out of the water. "I did," I said. "Not anymore." She studied me. "You loved him." She said it was a certainty that was both comforting and odd. "Yes," I said. Then I was embarrassed. "Not really. We only dated for a month." Alicia looked at Uncle Patrick. "How long have we been dating?" He smiled. "Dating? Is that what you call it? Well, what do you call it?" He took her in his arms and danced her through the water. "A love affair, my darling." "Oh, stop." She pretended to slap him and he fell back into the water. "You're a nice couple," I said. I had no such opinion. I had no opinion at all, but I wanted to insert myself. "Oh, no, we aren't," she said. "Let me tell you why. Your uncle here is of the upper classes, and I am, well, I'm lowly." She said this with humorous satisfaction. I looked at Uncle Patrick. He was smiling at Alicia. "Don't look at him," she scolded. "He's a fool. I know what's what." She breaststroked off to the center of the pool, a small wake lapping behind her. She turned around and said, "Oh, now, look at you, so woebegone. You're too pretty to look like that. I wish I had those big blue eyes. You could be a fashion model." I had been told I was pretty all my life, so the compliment had no effect. I wanted her to ask me if I was sad. I would have said I wasn't. Desperately, I needed to confess my unhappiness, but just as desperately, I wanted to hide it. "You know what you get a kick out of?" Uncle Patrick said. He wiggled his eyebrows the way he could, one seemingly independent of the other. "Going to the track." "I've never been," I said. "All the more reason," said Alicia. The three of us turned at the sound of my mother's car crunching into the driveway. She got out and waved and walked across the lawn to the pool. "Patrick, I hope you'll stay for dinner." "Hello," she said to Alicia. Saying hello showed that she was a lady. Not calling Alicia by her name and not inviting her to dinner was her way of protesting Alicia's presence in her pool. "We were just talking about the three of us going to the races tomorrow," Alicia said. I loved how unfazed she was by my mother. My mother frowned at Uncle Patrick. "Take Sarah to Belmont?" When she shook her head, her peppery hair didn't move. "No, Patrick. Why would you want to drive all the way to Long Island in this heat?" He winked at me when she glanced away. "I saw that," she said. She pointed at me. "Absolutely not." "Okay," I said. It didn't occur to me until later on that I was old enough to do as I pleased. And that's all. I'm going to read.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
So that's from the short story collection, No Diving Allowed. And the title of that story, Louise, is?
The Bottom of the Deep End.
The Bottom of the Deep End. Yeah, you know, writing coaches, experts say, make sure you engage the senses, you know, sight, sound, taste, mm-hmm. all that. And you certainly did that in there. Not all of them in that short passage, but you're definitely engaging the senses. And the banter between the characters was delicious. So,
thank you.
Wow.
Well, yeah, I think it's interesting that you say all that. I've never had a writing coach, and that's true, but I've never heard that before. Engage the senses.
Huh. Yeah. You know, I've been told, for instance, when I've heard somebody look at pieces of my writing, they would say, you know, you want to, somebody who's in that scene, they're going to want to hear something. They're going to want to smell something, maybe mm-hmm. taste something. And you don't do it in every scene because then mm-hmm. it becomes mechanistic and you're going to strain to do that. But it obviously comes naturally to you because it was definitely, you know, when you were talking, my senses were definitely engaged. And I really liked how you said she shook her head without her peppery hair moving.
Don't you know that hairdo? Yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I definitely saw it. She became very vivid as soon as you said that.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, boy. So Are you working on a new collection right now?
I am. Interestingly, for me, I've always said, Link stories. Oh, I've been snobby about them. Who would ever write Link stories? Just write a novel if you're going to do that. But it turns out, here I am, eating my words. I am writing a collection of Link stories, and they are linked by the same character who is the narrator. So it's written in first person. And she is a nut, and I'm having so much fun with her. She drinks too much, and she lies, and she's outrageous, and it's just hilarious to write. So it's very humorous.
How do you feel about writing first person versus third person? Talk about that. Do you prefer one over the other, and what do you see as maybe the chief difference?
I don't prefer one over the other. I often say it's what a story demands. Sometimes I'll switch. I'll be writing third person. I'll say, no, this needs to be first, or vice versa. If the character, the main character, I think needs to speak, from their own, voice, I think I'll do first person. I don't do first person a lot. And also, this collection that I'm writing, the new collection, is in present tense, something I almost never do. So this is a real departure. Present tense is just, I never really see the reason for it. But in this case, it gives it some urgency that I felt I needed. It makes it more humorous. And humor is not easy to write, I have to say. You have to really pay attention. So that's all different. But I don't have a preference. I just do whatever the story asks me to do.
Yeah, third person, I think, it gives you an opportunity to be omniscient and omnipresent. First person, although not to say, no real rules about it, but then I've heard people say they feel more connected to the writing if they write in first person. Some people have preferences as far as that goes, I don't think anybody's wed to any particular. I mean, most writers will sometimes write first person, and then sometimes it's third person. Or Jay McInerney blew me away when he wrote second person he wrote Bright Lights, Big City.
That can be fun, second person.
Constantly be told you do this, you do that. It really pulls you into the, not just pulls you into the story, but you feel like you're actually doing these things after you become mesmerized by the writing. And that was one of those early seminal novels for me where I read that and thought, wow, this was a debut novel. And I don't think he's equaled it since, but it was,
no, I don't
it was
either.
Really upstanding.
It was very smart, very funny novel. I agree. I don't even know what happened to him.
He's still out there. He's really into wine. He's into wine. Yeah. And he's come out, I think, recently with some new work, but he's very much a wine guy now. So what else should we know about Louise Marburg is relevant to the short story writing and writing in general or just titillating, let's say?
What to know about
maybe we shouldn't go there.
Well, the thing to know about me is that I am a voracious reader. Actually, during the pandemic, I have read much less. I find that the focus you need to read and the focus you need to write are very different. And I've had tremendous focus for writing. I wrote an entire book in the pandemic or lockdown. Or in lockdown in the months after, but I've not been able to read much. But normally, I read a lot, and I think that for me, that's has always been the most important component in my writing, is to read a lot and to aspire to the things that I read. I'm moving in the direction that I aspire to, but that's important to me. And I'm never very long not in a story. I might take a week or so between stories, but I'm pretty steady in the writing of them. So that's another thing about my process and about me. And I'm
looking at my husband right now. He's on his computer. So that's my life. And I look straight at his paintings.
He's supposed to be at the canvas right now. Is he doing some research here?
I have no idea what he's doing. It looks like he's reading something. But we have two dogs. We have two French bulldogs. And we're big French bulldog people. We've had many French bulldogs. So
when you read somebody, you say you aspire to, you want to read something mm-hmm. you can aspire to. Do you want to sound like, no. I mean, you mentioned John Cheever, and yeah. that would be a glorious thing to sound like John Cheever. And you've said you've been compared in that way.
Yeah.
Without bragging. Let's yeah. be clear yeah. that you weren't bragging.
Definitely not bragging.
But so you aspire to reach a certain level of quality, but you have your own voice. You feel like you have your own voice?
Oh, yes, for sure.
You do?
Okay. Oh, yeah. And, you know, yeah.
How long have you had your own voice? Did you have to work hard to get there? Right from the beginning, did you feel like you spoke and wrote in your own voice?
I think your voice changes as time goes along. With each book, I think your voice changes. But I, pretty early on in my MFA, I mean, I as I said, I was in love with Alice Munro. I was trying to write like her. So I write these huge 35-page stories that were terrible. But then I sort of settled into my own voice. And that voice has been honed over the years and become strangely I have a pretty good sense of humor. So my stories become much more humorous. And that's
describe your voice. Is it male? Is it female? Is it androgynous? Is it high pitched? Foreboding? It's not foreboding because you're a comedic writer.
No, so it's not
how
foreboding.
How would you describe your voice?
I would say it's very straightforward, I think. Definitely not womanly or female, but I'm not a man, so it's definitely not a man. So writing, I always say, if you want to write, say, a letter and sound like a man, just take out all the adjectives.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah. I think my writing is very smooth. I think it's quite readable and accessible. And that's what I really go for, accessible stories, because I don't like the idea that not everybody is going to enjoy these if it's the sort of thing they enjoy.
Yeah, I'm with you. There's people who write these very dense books. They, and it's kind of impenetrable. Yeah. They make you work too hard.
Yeah.
And it's not that I'm not willing to work in stretches, but I like the idea of it being certainly accessible. I like feeling like I'm in the story, and it's hard to feel in the story when
you're trying to keep
people
out.
Be honest, Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace.
Impossible.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those books that it's so celebrated, but when I tried to read it, it was just like, I can't do this, and I don't know. It kind of makes you feel less than at times because people say such great things about it, but it's like, I can't read this. It's just he's trying too hard to be sophisticated, and he's making you work too hard to suss out the meaning of every statement and every scene. So I gave up on that one pretty early. But accessibility is, and certainly what you read was very accessible, but it was not simplistic by any stretch.
Well, I think it's so important that someone can, there be many layers of a story or a novel, and somebody can go with whatever layer they are interested in, whatever theme. I think a good story or a good novel should have layers. But I, to your point about being in the story, I don't think you can be in a story if you're trying to keep people out of it. So that for me is the main thing. I don't think of an audience, but I do think, I'm not trying to keep anyone from understanding this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So her name is Louise Marburg. You can learn more about her. I have the link in the program notes below. LouiseMarburg.com will give you more information about her. Short story writer. Louise, this has been really interesting. I've been wanting to have somebody on to discuss short stories and kind of the why and wherefore, why people favor short stories over the longer form and so on. And you've certainly done that, and beautifully beautifully written prose, and what you read today was a nice sample. So I really appreciate you taking the time coming on the program, and I wish you best of luck in the future.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for having me on. It's been really fun.